The anthem plays, and my throat tightens with revulsion as President Snow takes the stage. He's followed by a young boy dressed in a white suit, holding a simple wooden box. The anthem ends, and President Snow begins to speak to remind us all of the dark days from which the Hunger Games were born. When the laws of the games were laid out, they dictated that every 25 years the anniversary would be marked by a quarter quell. It would call for a glorified version of the games to make fresh the memory of those killed by the district's rebellion. These words could not be more pointed, since I suspect several districts are rebelling right now. President Snow goes on to tell us what happened in the previous quarter quells. On the 25th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that their children were dying because of their choice to initiate violence, every district was made to hold an election and vote on the tributes who would represent it. I wonder how that would have felt, picking the kids who had to go. It is worse, I think, to be turned over by your own neighbors than to have your name drawn from the reaping ball. On the 50th anniversary, the president continues, as a reminder that two rebels died for each capital citizen, every district was required to send twice as many tributes. I imagine facing a field of 47 instead of 23. Worse odds, less hope, and ultimately, more dead kids. That was the year Haymitch won. I had a friend who went that year, says my mother quietly. Maisalie Donner. Her parents owned the sweet shop. They gave me her songbird after, a canary. Prim and I exchange a look. It's the first time we've ever heard of Maisalie Donner. Maybe because my mother knew we would want to know how she died. And now we honor our third quarter quell, says the president. The little boy in white steps forward, holding out the box as he opens the lid. We can see the tidy upright rows of yellowed envelopes. Whoever devised the quarter quell system had prepared for centuries of Hunger Games. The president removes an envelope clearly marked with a 75. He runs his finger under the flap and pulls out a small square of paper. Without hesitation, he reads, "On the 75th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that even the strongest among them cannot overcome the power of the capital, the male and female tributes will be reaped from their existing pool of victors." My mother gives a faint shriek, and Prim buries her face in her hands. But I feel more like the people I see in the crowd on television, slightly baffled. What does it mean? Existing pool of victors? Then I get it, what it means, at least for me. District 12 only has 3 existing victors to choose from. 2 male, 1 female. I am going back into the arena. Chapter 13. My body reacts before my mind does, and I'm running out the door, across the lawns of the victor's village, into the dark beyond. Moisture from the sodden ground soaks my socks, and I'm aware of the sharp bite of the wind, but I don't stop. Where to go? The woods, of course. I'm at the fence before the hum makes me remember how very trapped I am. I back away, panting, turn on my heel, and take off again. The next thing I know, I'm on my hands and knees in the cellar of one of the empty houses in the victor's village. Faint shafts of moonlight come in through the window wells above my head. I'm cold and wet and winded, but my escape attempt has done nothing to subdue the hysteria rising up inside me. It will drown me unless it's released. I ball up the front of my shirt, stuff it into my mouth, and begin to scream. How long this continues, I don't know, but when I stop, My voice is almost gone. I curl up on my side and stare at the patches of moonlight on the cement floor. Back in the arena. Back in the place of nightmares. That's where I'm going. I have to admit, I didn't see it coming. I saw a multitude of other things being publicly humiliated, tortured, and executed, fleeing through the wilderness, pursued by peacekeepers and hovercraft. Marriage to Peeta, with our children forced into the arena. But never that I myself would have to be a player in the games again. Why? Because there's no precedent for it. Victors are out of the reaping for life. That's the deal if you win. Until now. There's some kind of sheeting, the kind they put down when they paint. I pull it over me like a blanket. In the distance, someone is calling my name. But at the moment, I excuse myself from thinking about even those I love most. I think only of me and what lies ahead. The sheeting's stiff but holds warmth. My muscles relax. My heart rate slows. I see the wooden box in the little boy's hands, President Snow drawing out the yellowed envelope. Is it possible that this was really the quarter quell written down 75 years ago? It seems unlikely. It's just too perfect an answer for the troubles that face the capital today. Getting rid of me and subduing the districts all in one neat little package. I hear President Snow's voice in my head. On the 75th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that even the strongest among them cannot overcome the power of the capital, the male and female tributes will be reaped from their existing pool of victors. Yes, victors are our strongest. They're the ones who survived the arena and slipped the noose of poverty that strangles the rest of us. They, or should I say we, are the very embodiment of hope where there is no hope. And now, 23 of us will be killed to show how even that hope was an illusion. I'm glad I won only last year. Otherwise, I'd know all the other victors, not just because I see them on television, but because they're guests at every games. Even if they're not mentoring like Haymitch always has to, most return to the capital each year for the event. I think a lot of them are friends, whereas the only friend I'll have to worry about killing will be either Peeta or Haymitch. Peeta or Haymitch! I sit straight up, throwing off the sheeting. What just went through my mind? There's no situation in which I would ever kill Peeta or Haymitch. But one of them will be in the arena with me, and that's a fact. They may have even decided between them who it will be. Whoever is picked first, the other will have the option of volunteering to take his place. I already know what will happen. Peeta will ask Haymitch to let him go into the arena with me no matter what, for my sake, to protect me. I stumble around the cellar looking for an exit. How did I even get into this place? I feel my way up the steps to the kitchen and see the glass window in the door has been shattered. Must be why my hand seems to be bleeding. I hurry back into the night and head straight to Haymitch's house. He's sitting alone at the kitchen table, a half-emptied bottle of white liquor in one fist, his knife in the other, drunk as a skunk.
Ah, oh, there she is, all tuckered out. Finally did the math, did you, sweetheart? Worked out you won't be going in alone. And now you're here to ask me what, he says.
I don't answer. The window's wide open and the wind cuts through me just as if I were outside.
I'll admit, it was easier for the boy. He was here before I could snap the seal on a bottle, begging me for another chance to go in. But what can you say?
He mimics my voice.
Take his place, Haymitch. Because all things being equal, I'd rather Peeta had a crack at the rest of his life than you.
I bit my lip, because once he said it, I'm afraid that's what I do want. For Peter to live, even if it means Haymitch's death. No, I don't. He's dreadful, of course, but Haymitch is my family now. What did I come for, I think? What could I possibly want here? I came for a drink, I say. Haymitch bursts out laughing and slams the bottle on the table before me. I run my sleeve across the top and take a couple gulps before I come up, choking. It takes a few minutes to compose myself, and even then my eyes and nose are still streaming. But inside me, the liquor feels like fire, and I like it. Maybe it should be you, I say matter-of-factly as I pull up a chair. You hate life anyway.
Very true, says Haymitch. And since last time I tried to keep you alive, seems like I'm obligated to save the boy this time.
That's another good point, I say, wiping my nose and tipping up the bottle again.
Peter's argument is that since I chose you, I now owe him anything he wants, and what he wants is the chance to go in again to protect you, says Haymitch.
I knew it. In this way, Peter's not hard to predict. While I was wallowing around on the floor of that cellar, thinking only of myself, he was here, thinking only of me. Shame isn't a strong enough word for what I feel.
You could live 100 lifetimes and not deserve him, you know, Haymitch says.
Yeah, yeah, I say brusquely. No question, he's the superior one of this trio. So what are you going to do?
I don't know, Haymitch sighs. Go back in with you, maybe, if I can. If my name's drawn at the reaping, it won't matter. He'll just volunteer to take my place.
We sit for a while in silence. It'd be bad for you in the arena, wouldn't it, knowing all of the others? I ask.
Oh, I think we can count on it being unbearable wherever I am.
He nods at the bottle.
Can I have that back now?
No, I say, wrapping my arms around it. Haymitch pulls another bottle out from under the table and gives the top a twist. But I realize I am not just here for a drink. There's something else I want from Haymitch. Okay, I figured out what I'm asking, I say. If it is Peter and me in the games, this time we try to keep him alive. Something flickers across his bloodshot eyes. Pain. Like you said, it's going to be bad no matter how you slice it. And whatever Peter wants, it's his turn to be saved. We both owe him that. My voice takes on a pleading tone. Besides, the capital hates me so much I'm as good as dead now. He still might have a chance. Please, Haymitch, say you'll help me. He frowns at his bottle, weighing my words.
All right, he says finally.
Thanks, I say. I should go see Peter now, but I don't want to. My head's spinning from the drink, and I'm so wiped out, who knows what he could get me to agree to. No, now I have to go home to face my mother and Prim. As I stagger up the steps to my house, the front door opens and Gale pulls me into his arms.
I was wrong. We should have gone when you said, he whispers.
No, I say. I'm having trouble focusing, and liquor keeps sloshing out of my bottle and down the back of Gale's jacket, but he doesn't seem to care.
It's not too late, he says.
Over his shoulder, I see my mother and Prim clutching each other in the doorway. We run, they die. And now I've got Peter to protect. End of discussion. Yeah, it is. My knees give way, and he's holding me up. As the alcohol overcomes my mind, I hear the glass bottle shatter on the floor. This seems appropriate, since I have obviously lost my grip on everything. When I wake up, I barely get to the toilet before the white liquor makes its reappearance. It burns just as much coming up as it did going down, and tastes twice as bad. I'm trembling and sweaty when I finish vomiting, but at least most of the stuff is out of my system. Enough made it into my bloodstream, though, to result in a pounding headache, parched mouth, and boiling stomach. I turn on the shower and stand under the warm rain for a minute before I realize I'm still in my underclothes. My mother must have stripped off my filthy outer ones and tucked me in bed. I throw the wet undergarments into the sink and pour shampoo on my head. My hands sting, and that's when I notice the stitches, small and even, across one palm and up the side of the other hand. Vaguely, I remember breaking that glass window last night. I scrub myself from head to toe, only stopping to throw up again right in the shower. It's mostly just bile and goes down the drain with the sweet-smelling bubbles. Finally clean, I pull on my robe and head back to bed, ignoring my dripping hair. I climb under the blankets, sure this is what it must feel like to be poisoned. The footsteps on the stairs renew my panic from last night. I'm not ready to see my mother and Prim. I have to pull myself together to be calm and reassuring, the way I was when we said our goodbyes the day of the last reaping. I have to be strong. I struggle into an upright position, push my wet hair off my throbbing temples, and brace myself for this meeting. They appear in the doorway, holding tea and toast, their faces filled with concern. I open my mouth, planning to start off with some kind of joke, and burst into tears. So much for being strong. My mother sits on the side of the bed, and Prim crawls right up next to me, and they hold me, making quiet, soothing sounds, until I am mostly cried out. Then Prim gets a towel and dries my hair, combing out the knots, while my mother coaxes tea and toast into me. They dress me in warm pajamas and layer more blankets on me, and I drift off again. I can tell by the light it's late afternoon when I come round again. There's a glass of water on my bedside table, and I gulp it down, thirstily. My stomach and head still feel rocky, but much better than they did earlier. I rise, dress, and braid back my hair. Before I go down, I pause at the top of the stairs, feeling slightly embarrassed about the way I've handled the news of the quarter quell. My erratic flight, drinking with Haymitch, weeping. Given the circumstances, I guess I deserve one day of indulgence. I'm glad the cameras weren't here for it, though. Downstairs, my mother and Prim embrace me again, but they're not overly emotional. I know they're holding things in to make it easier on me. Looking at Prim's face, it's hard to imagine she's the same frail little girl I left behind on Reaping Day 9 months ago. The combination of that ordeal and all that has followed, the cruelty in the district, the parade of sick and wounded that she often treats by herself now if my mother's hands are too full, these things have aged her years. She's grown quite a bit, too. We're practically the same height now, but that isn't what makes her seem so much older. My mother ladles out a mug of broth for me, and I ask for a second mug to take to Haymitch. Then I walk across the lawn to his house. He's only just waking up and accepts the mug without comment. We sit there, almost peacefully, sipping our broth and watching the sun set through his living room window. I hear someone walking around upstairs, and I assume it's Hazel. But a few minutes later, Peeta comes down and tosses a cardboard box of empty liquor bottles on the table with finality. "There, it's done," he says. It's taking all of Hamish's resources to focus his eyes on the bottles, so I speak up. "What's done?" "I've poured all the liquor down the drain," says Peeta. This seems to jolt Haymitch out of his stupor,
and he paused through the box in disbelief.
You what?
I tossed the lot, says Peter. He'll just buy more, I say. No, he won't, says Peter. I tracked down Ripper this morning and told her I'd turn her in the second she sold to either of you. I paid her off, too, just for good measure, but I don't think she's eager to be back in the peacekeeper's custody. Haymitch takes a swipe with his knife, but Peter deflects it so easily it's pathetic. Anger rises up in me. What business is it of yours what he does? It's completely my business. However it falls out, two of us are going to be in the arena again, with the other as mentor. We can't afford any drunkards on this team, especially not you, Katniss, says Peter to me.
What?
I sputter indignantly. It would be more convincing if I weren't still so hungover. Last night's the only time I've ever even been drunk.
Yeah, and look at the shape you're in, says Peter. I don't know what I expected from my first meeting with Peter after the announcement. A few hugs and kisses. A little comfort, maybe. Not this. I turned to Haymitch. Don't worry, I'll get you more liquor.
Then I'll turn you both in, let you sober up in the stocks, says Peter.
What's the point to this?
Asks Haymitch. The point is that two of us are coming home from the capital, one mentor and one victor, says Peter. Effie's sending me recordings of all the living victors. We're going to watch their games and learn everything we can about how they fight. We're going to put on weight and get strong. We're going to start acting like careers, and one of us is going to be victor again, whether you two like it or not. He sweeps out of the room, slamming the front door. Haymitch and I wince at the bang.
I don't like self-righteous people, I say.
What's to like?
Says Haymitch, who begins sucking the dregs out of the empty bottles.
You and me. That's who he plans on coming home, I say.
Well, then the joke's on him, says Haymitch.
But after a few days, we agree to act like careers, because this is the best way to get Peter ready as well. Every night we watch the old recaps of the games that the remaining victors won. I realize we never met any of them on the victory tour, which seems odd in retrospect. When I bring it up, Haymitch says the last thing President Snow would have wanted was to show Peter and me, especially me, bonding with other victors in potentially rebellious districts. Victors have a special status, and if they appeared to be supporting my defiance of the capital, it would have been dangerous politically. Adjusting for age, I realize some of our opponents may be elderly, which is both sad and reassuring. Peter takes copious notes. Haymitch volunteers information about the victors' personalities, and slowly we begin to know our competition. Every morning we do exercises to strengthen our bodies. We run and lift things and stretch our muscles. Every afternoon we work on combat skills, throwing knives, fighting hand to hand. I even teach them to climb trees. Officially, tributes aren't supposed to train, but no one tries to stop us. Even in regular years, the tributes from District 1, 2, and 4 show up able to wield spears and swords. This is nothing by comparison. After all the years of abuse, Haymitch's body resists improvement. He's still remarkably strong, but the shortest run wins him. And you'd think a guy who sleeps every night with a knife might actually be able to hit the side of a house with one, but his hands shake so badly it takes weeks for him to achieve even that. Peter and I excel under the new regimen, though. It gives me something to do. It gives us all something to do besides accept defeat. My mother puts us on a special diet to gain weight. Prim treats our sore muscles. Madge sneaks us her father's capital newspapers,
Predictions on who will be victor of the victors show us among the favorites. Even Gale steps into the picture on Sundays, although he's got no love for Peeta or Haymitch, and teaches us all he knows about snares. It's weird for me, being in conversations with both Peeta and Gale, but they seem to have set aside whatever issues they have about me. One night, as I'm walking Gale back into town, he even admits, "It'd be better if he were easier to hate." "Tell me about it," I say. "If I could have just hated him in the arena, we all wouldn't be in this mess now. He'd be dead, and I'd be a happy little victor all by myself."
"And where would we be, Katniss?" asks Gale.
I pause, not knowing what to say. Where would I be with my pretend cousin, who wouldn't be my cousin if it weren't for Peeta? Would he have still kissed me, and would I have kissed him back, had I been free to do so? Would I have let myself open up to him, lulled by the security of money and food, and the illusion of safety being a victor could bring under different circumstances? But there would still always be the reaping looming over us, over our children, no matter what I wanted. "Hunting, like every Sunday," I say. I know he didn't mean the question literally, but this is as much as I can honestly give. Gale knows I chose him over Peeta when I didn't make a run for it. To me, there's no point in talking about things that might have been. Even if I had killed Peeta in the arena, I still wouldn't have wanted to marry anyone. I only got engaged to save people's lives, and that completely backfired. I'm afraid, anyway, that any kind of emotional scene with Gale might cause him to do something drastic, like start that uprising in the mines. And as Haymitch says, District 12 isn't ready for that. If anything, they're less ready than before the Quarter Quell announcement, because the following morning, another 100 peacekeepers arrived on the train. Since I don't plan on making it back alive a second time, the sooner Gale lets me go, the better. I do plan on saying one or two things to him after the reaping, when we're allowed an hour for goodbyes. To let Gale know how essential he's been to me all these years. How much better my life has been for knowing him, for loving him, even if only in the limited way that I can manage. But I never get the chance. The day of the reaping's hot and sultry. The population of District 12 waits, sweating and silent, in the square with machine guns trained on them. I stand alone in a small roped-off area, with Peeta and Haymitch in a similar pen to the right of me. The reaping takes only a minute. Effie, shining in a wig of metallic gold, lacks her usual verve. She has to claw around the girl's reaping ball for quite a while to snag the one piece of paper that everyone already knows has my name on it. Then she catches Haymitch's name. He barely has time to shoot me an unhappy look before Peeta has volunteered to take his place. We are immediately marched into the justice building to find head peacekeeper Thread waiting for us. "New procedure," he says with a smile. We're ushered out the back door, into a car, and taken to the train station. There are no cameras on the platform, no crowd to send us on our way. Haymitch and Effie appear, escorted by guards. Peacekeepers hurry us all onto the train and slam the door. The wheels begin to turn, and I'm left staring out the window, watching District 12 disappear with all my goodbyes still hanging on my lips. Chapter 14. I remain at the window long after the woods have swallowed up the last glimpse of my home. This time I don't have even the slightest hope of return. Before my first games, I promised Prim I would do everything I could to win. And now I've sworn to myself to do all I can to keep Peeta alive. I will never reverse this journey again.
I'd actually figured out what I wanted my last words to my loved ones to be, how best to close and lock the doors and leave them sad but safely behind. And now the Capitol has stolen that as well. "We'll write letters, Katniss," says Peeta from behind me. "It will be better anyway. Give them a piece of us to hold on to. Haymitch will deliver them for us, if they need to be delivered." I nod and go straight to my room. I sit on the bed, knowing I will never write those letters. They will be like the speech I tried to write to honor Rue and Thresh in District 11. Things seemed clear in my head, and even when I talked before the crowd, but the words never came out of the pen right. Besides, they were meant to go with embraces and kisses and a stroke of Prim's hair, a caress of Gale's face, a squeeze of Madge's hand. They cannot be delivered with a wooden box containing my cold, stiff body. Too heartsick to cry, all I want is to curl up on the bed and sleep until we arrive in the Capitol tomorrow morning. But I have a mission. No, it's more than a mission. It's my dying wish. Keep Peeta alive. And as unlikely as it seems that I can achieve it in the face of the Capitol's anger, it's important that I be at the top of my game. This won't happen if I'm mourning for everyone I love back home. Let them go, I tell myself. Say goodbye and forget them. I do my best, thinking of them one by one, releasing them like birds from the protective cages inside me, locking the doors against their return. By the time Effie knocks on my door to call me to dinner, I'm empty, but the lightness isn't entirely unwelcome. The meal's subdued, so subdued, in fact, that there are long periods of silence, relieved only by the removal of old dishes and presentation of new ones. A cold soup of pureed vegetables, fish cakes with creamy lime paste, those little birds filled with orange sauce, with wild rice and watercress, chocolate custard dotted with cherries. Peeta and Effie make occasional attempts at conversation that quickly die out. "I love your new hair, Effie," Peeta says.
"Thank you. I had it especially done to match Katniss's pin. I was thinking we might get you a golden ankle band and maybe find Haymitch a gold bracelet or something so we could all look like a team," says Effie.
Evidently, Effie doesn't know that my Mockingjay pin is now a symbol used by the rebels, at least in District 8. In the Capitol, the Mockingjay is still a fun reminder of an especially exciting Hunger Games. What else could it be? Real rebels don't put a secret symbol on something as durable as jewelry. They put it on a wafer of bread that can be eaten in a second if necessary.
"I think that's a great idea," says Peeta. "How about it, Haymitch?"
"Yeah, whatever," says Haymitch.
He's not drinking, but I can tell he'd like to be. Effie had them take her own wine away when she saw the effort he was making, but he's in a miserable state. If he were the tribute, he would have owed Peeta nothing and could be as drunk as he liked. Now it's going to take all he's got to keep Peeta alive in an arena full of his old friends, and he'll probably fail.
"Maybe we could get you a wig, too," I say in an attempt at lightness.
He just shoots me a look that says leave him alone, and we all eat our custard in silence.
"Shall we watch the recap of the reapings?" says Effie, dabbing at the corners of her mouth with a white linen napkin.
Peeta goes off to retrieve his notebook on the remaining living victors, and we gather in the compartment with the television to see who our competition will be in the arena. We are all in place as the anthem begins to play, and the annual recap of the reaping ceremonies in the 12 districts begins. In the history of the games, there have been 75 victors. 59 are still alive. I recognize many of their faces, either from seeing them as tributes or mentors at previous games, or from our recent viewing of the victors' tapes.
Some are so old or wasted by illness, drugs, or drink that I can't place them. As one would expect, the pools of career tributes from Districts 1, 2, and 4 are the largest, but every district has managed to scrape up at least one female and one male victor. The reapings go by quickly. Peter studiously puts stars by the names of the chosen tributes in his notebook. Haymitch watches, his face devoid of emotion, as friends of his step up to take the stage. Effie makes hushed, distressed comments like,
"Oh, not Cecilia,"
or,
"Well, Chaff never could stay out of a fight,"
and sighs frequently. For my part, I try to make some mental record of the other tributes, but like last year, only a few really stick in my head. There's the classically beautiful brother and sister from District 1 who were victors in consecutive years when I was little. Brutus, a volunteer from District 2, who must be at least 40 and apparently can't wait to get back in the arena. Finnick, the handsome bronze-haired guy from District 4, who was crowned 10 years ago at the age of 14. A hysterical young woman with flowing brown hair is also called from 4. But she's quickly replaced by a volunteer, an 80-year-old woman who needs a cane to walk to the stage. Then there's Joanna Mason, the only living female victor from 7, who won a few years back by pretending she was a weakling. The woman from 8, who Effie calls Cecilia, who looks about 30, has to detach herself from the 3 kids who run up to cling to her. Chaff, a man from 11, who I know to be one of Haymitch's particular friends, is also in. I'm called, then Haymitch, and Peter volunteers. One of the announcers actually gets teary because it seems the odds will never be in our favor. We star-crossed lovers of District 12. Then she pulls herself together to say she bets that these will be the best games ever. Haymitch leaves the compartment without a word, and Effie, after making a few unconnected comments about this tribute or that, bids us good night. I just sit there watching Peter rip out the pages of the victors who were not picked.
"Why don't you get some sleep?" he says.
"Because I can't handle the nightmares. Not without you, I think. They are sure to be dreadful tonight, but I can hardly ask Peter to come sleep with me. We've barely touched since that night Gail was whipped." "What are you going to do?" I ask.
"Just review my notes a while, get a clear picture of what we're up against. But I'll go over it with you in the morning. Go to bed, Katniss," he says.
So I go to bed, and sure enough, within a few hours, I awake from a nightmare where that old woman from District 4 transforms into a large rodent and gnaws on my face. I know I was screaming, but no one comes. Not Peter, not even one of the Capitol attendants. I pull on a robe to try to calm the goose flesh crawling over my body. Staying in my compartment is impossible, so I decide to go find someone to make me tea or hot chocolate or anything. Maybe Haymitch is still up. Surely he isn't asleep. I order warm milk, the most calming thing I can think of, from an attendant. Hearing voices from the television room, I go in and find Peter. Beside him on the couch is the box Effie sent of tapes of the old Hunger Games. I recognize the episode in which Brutus became victor. Peter rises and flips off the tape when he sees me.
"Couldn't sleep?"
"Not for long," I say. I pull the robe more securely around me as I remember the old woman transforming into the rodent.
"Want to talk about it?" he asks.
Sometimes that can help, but I just shake my head, feeling weak that people I haven't even fought yet already haunt me. When Peter holds out his arms, I walk straight into them. It's the first time since they announced the Quarter Quell that he's offered me any sort of affection. He's been more like a very demanding trainer, always pushing, always insisting Haymitch and I run faster, eat more, know our enemy better.
Lover? Forget about that.
He abandoned any pretense of even being my friend. I wrap my arms tightly around his neck before he can order me to do push-ups or something. Instead, he pulls me in close and buries his face in my hair. Warmth radiates from the spot where his lips just touch my neck, slowly spreading through the rest of me. It feels so good, so impossibly good, that I know I will not be the first to let go. And why should I? I have said goodbye to Gale. I'll never see him again, that's for certain. Nothing I do now can hurt him. He won't see it, or he'll think I'm acting for the cameras. That, at least, is one weight off my shoulders. The arrival of the Capitol attendant with the warm milk is what breaks us apart. He sets a tray with a steaming ceramic jug and two mugs on a table. "I brought an extra cup," he says. "Thanks," I say. "And I added a touch of honey to the milk, for sweetness, and just a pinch of spice," he adds. He looks at us like he wants to say more, then gives his head a slight shake and backs out of the room. "What's with him?" I say. "I think he feels bad for us," says Peter. "Right," I say, pouring the milk. "I mean it. I don't think the people in the Capitol are going to be all that happy about our going back in," says Peter. "Or the other victors. They get attached to their champions." "I'm guessing they'll get over it once the blood starts flowing," I say flatly. "Really, if there's one thing I don't have time for, it's worrying about how the quarter quell will affect the mood in the Capitol." "So you're watching all the tapes again?" "Not really. Just sort of skipping around to see people's different fighting techniques," says Peter. "Who's next?" I ask. "You pick," says Peter, holding out the box. The tapes are marked with the year of the games and the name of the victor. I dig around and suddenly find one in my hand that we have not watched. The year of the games is 50. That would make it the second quarter quell. And the name of the victor is Haymitch Abernathy. "We never watched this one," I say. Peter shakes his head. "No, I knew Haymitch didn't want to, the same way we didn't want to relive our own games. And since we're all on the same team, I didn't think it mattered much." "Is the person who won in 25 in here?" I ask. "I don't think so. Whoever it was must be dead by now. And Effie only sent me victors we might have to face." Peter weighs Haymitch's tape in his hand. "Why? You think we ought to watch it?" "It's the only quell we have. We might pick up something valuable about how they work," I say. "But I feel weird. It seems like some major invasion of Haymitch's privacy. I don't know why it should, since the whole thing was public, but it does. I have to admit, I'm also extremely curious. We don't have to tell Haymitch we saw it." "Okay," Peter agrees. He puts in the tape and I curl up next to him on the couch with my milk, which is really delicious with the honey and the spices, and lose myself in the 50th Hunger Games. After the anthem, they show President Snow drawing the envelope for the second quarter quell. He looks younger, but just as repellent. He reads from the square of paper in the same onerous voice he used for hours, informing Panem that in honor of the quarter quell, there will be twice the number of tributes. The editors smash cut right into the reapings, where name after name after name is called. By the time we get to District 12, I'm completely overwhelmed by the sheer number of kids going to certain death. There's a woman, not Effie, calling the names in 12, but she still begins with, "Ladies first." She calls out the name of a girl who's from the seam. You can tell by the look of her. And then I hear the name. Maisalie Donner. "Oh," I say. "She was my mother's friend." The cameras find her in the crowd, clinging to two other girls, all blonde, all definitely merchants' kids. "I think that's your mother hugging her," says Peter quietly. And he's right. As Maisie Donner bravely disengages herself and heads for the stage, I catch a glimpse of my mother at my age, and no one has exaggerated her beauty. Holding her hand and weeping is another girl who looks just like Maisie, but a lot like someone else I know, too. "Madge," I say. "That's her mother. She and Maisie were twins or something," Peter says. "My dad mentioned it once." I think of Madge's mother, Mayor Undersea's wife, who spends half her life in bed, immobilized with terrible pain, shutting out the world. I think of how I never realized that she and my mother shared this connection, of Madge showing up in that snowstorm to bring the painkiller for Gale, of my Mockingjay pin, and how it means something completely different now that I know that its former owner was Madge's aunt, Maisie Donner, a tribute who was murdered in the arena. Haymitch's name is called last of all. It's more of a shock to see him than my mother. Young, strong, hard to admit, but he was something of a looker. His hair dark and curly, those gray seam eyes bright and, even then, dangerous. "Oh, Peter, you don't think he killed Maisie, do you?" I burst out. I don't know why, but I can't stand the thought. "With 48 players, I'd say the odds are against it," says Peter. The chariot rides, in which the District 12 kids are dressed in awful coal miners' outfits, and the interviews flash by. There's little time to focus on anyone, but since Haymitch is going to be the victor, we get to see one full exchange between him and Caesar Flickerman, who looks exactly as he always does, in his twinkling midnight blue suit. Only his dark green hair, eyelids, and lips are different.
"So, Haymitch, what do you think of the games having 100% more competitors than usual?" asks Caesar.
Haymitch shrugs. "I don't see that it makes much difference. They'll still be 100% as stupid as usual, so I figure my odds will be roughly the same." The audience bursts out laughing, and Haymitch gives them a half-smile. Snarky, arrogant, indifferent. "He didn't have to reach far for that, did he?" I say. Now it's the morning the games begin. We watch from the point of view of one of the tributes as she rises up through the tube from the launch room and into the arena. I can't help but give a slight gasp. Disbelief is reflected on the faces of the players. Even Haymitch's eyebrows lift in pleasure, although they almost immediately knit themselves back into a scowl. It's the most breathtaking place imaginable. The golden cornucopia sits in the middle of a green meadow with patches of gorgeous flowers. The sky is azure blue with puffy white clouds. Bright songbirds flutter overhead. By the way, some of the tributes are sniffing. It must smell fantastic. An aerial shot shows that the meadow stretches for miles. Far in the distance, in one direction, there seems to be a woods. In the other, a snow-capped mountain. The beauty disorients many of the players, because when the gong sounds, most of them seem like they're trying to wake from a dream. Not Haymitch, though. He's at the cornucopia, armed with weapons and a backpack of choice supplies. He heads for the woods before most of the others have stepped off their plates. 18 tributes are killed in the bloodbath that first day. Others begin to die off, and it becomes clear that almost everything in this pretty place, the luscious fruit dangling from the bushes, the water in the crystalline streams, even the scent of the flowers when inhaled too directly, is deadly poisonous. Only the rainwater and the food provided at the cornucopia are safe to consume. There's also a large, well-stocked career pack of 10 tributes scouring the mountain area for victims. Haymitch has his own troubles over in the woods, where the fluffy golden squirrels turn out to be carnivorous and attack in packs, and the butterfly stings bring agony, if not death. But he persists in moving forward, always keeping the distant mountain at his back. Maisalie Donner turns out to be pretty resourceful herself for a girl who leaves the cornucopia with only a small backpack. Inside she finds a bowl, some dried beef, and a blowgun with 2 dozen darts. Making use of the readily available poisons, she soon turns the blowgun into a deadly weapon by dipping the darts in lethal substances and directing them into her opponent's flesh. 4 days in, the picturesque mountain erupts in a volcano that wipes out another 12 players, including all but 5 of the career pack. With the mountain spewing liquid fire and the meadow offering no means of concealment, the remaining 13 tributes, including Haymitch and Maisalie, have no choice but to confine themselves to the woods. Haymitch seems bent on continuing in the same direction, away from the now volcanic mountain, but a maze of tightly woven hedges forces him to circle back into the center of the woods, where he encounters 3 of the careers and pulls his knife. They may be much bigger and stronger, but Haymitch has remarkable speed and has killed 2 when the 3rd disarms him. That career is about to slit his throat when a dart drops him to the ground. Maisalie Donner steps out of the woods.
"We'd live longer with 2 of us."
"Guess you just proved that," says Haymitch, rubbing his neck. "Allies?"
Maisalie nods, and there they are, instantly drawn into one of those pacts you'd be hard-pressed to break if you ever expect to go home and face your district. Just like Peeta and me, they do better together. Get more rest, work out a system to salvage more rainwater, fight as a team, and share the food from the dead tributes' packs. But Haymitch is still determined to keep moving on.
"Why?"
Maisalie keeps asking, and he ignores her until she refuses to move any further without an answer.
"Because it has to end somewhere, right?" says Haymitch. "The arena can't go on forever."
"What do you expect to find?" Maisalie asks.
"I don't know, but maybe there's something we can use," he says.
When they finally do make it through that impossible hedge, using a blowtorch from one of the dead career's packs, they find themselves on flat, dry earth that leads to a cliff. Far below, you can see jagged rocks.
"That's all there is, Haymitch. Let's go back," says Maisalie. "No, I'm staying here," he says.
"All right. There's only 5 of us left. May as well say goodbye now anyway," she says. "I don't want it to come down to you and me."
"Okay," he agrees. "That's all." He doesn't offer to shake her hand or even look at her, and she walks away.
Haymitch skirts along the edge of the cliff as if trying to figure something out. His foot dislodges a pebble and it falls into the abyss, apparently gone forever. But a minute later, as he sits to rest, the pebble shoots back up beside him. Haymitch stares at it, puzzled, and then his face takes on a strange intensity. He lobs a rock the size of his fist over the cliff and waits. When it flies back out and right into his hand, he starts laughing. That's when we hear Maisalie begin to scream. The alliance is over, and she broke it off, so no one could blame him for ignoring her. But Haymitch runs for her anyway. He arrives only in time to watch the last of a flock of candy pink birds, equipped with long, thin beaks, skewer her through the neck. He holds her hand while she dies, and all I can think of is Rue, and how I was too late to save her, too. Later that day, another tribute is killed in combat, and a 3rd gets eaten by a pack of those fluffy squirrels, leaving Haymitch and a girl from District 1 to vie for the crown. She's bigger than he is and just as fast, and when the inevitable fight comes, it's bloody and awful, and both have received what could well be fatal wounds. When Haymitch is finally disarmed, he staggers through the beautiful woods, holding his intestines in, while she stumbles after him, carrying the axe that should deliver his death blow. Haymitch makes a beeline for his cliff, and has just reached the edge when she throws the axe. He collapses on the ground and it flies into the abyss. Now weaponless as well, the girl just stands there, trying to staunch the flow of blood pouring from her empty eye socket. She's thinking perhaps that she can outlast Haymitch, who's starting to convulse on the ground. But what she doesn't know, and what he does, is that the axe will return. And when it flies back over the ledge, it buries itself in her head. The cannon sounds, her body is removed, and the trumpets blow to announce Haymitch's victory. Peter clicks off the tape and we sit there in silence for a while. Finally, Peter says, "That force field at the bottom of the cliff, it was like the one on the top of the training center. The one that throws you back if you try to jump off and commit suicide. Haymitch found a way to turn it into a weapon. Not just against the other tributes, but the capital too," I say. "You know they didn't expect that to happen. It wasn't meant to be part of the arena. They never planned on anyone using it as a weapon. It made them look stupid that he figured it out. I bet they had a good time trying to spin that one. But that's why I don't remember seeing it on television. It's almost as bad as us and the berries." I can't help laughing, really laughing, for the first time in months. Peter just shakes his head like I've lost my mind. And maybe I have, a little.
"Almost, but not quite," says Haymitch from behind us.
I whip around, afraid he's going to be angry over us watching his tape, but he just smirks and takes a swig from a bottle of wine. So much for sobriety. I guess I should be upset he's drinking again, but I'm preoccupied with another feeling. I've spent all these weeks getting to know who my competitors are, without even thinking about who my teammates are. Now a new kind of confidence is lighting up inside of me, because I think I finally know who Haymitch is, and I'm beginning to know who I am. And surely two people who have caused the capital so much trouble can think of a way to get Peter home alive.
Chapter 15. Having been through prep with Flavius, Venia, and Octavia numerous times, it should just be an old routine to survive. But I haven't anticipated the emotional ordeal that awaits me. At some point during the prep, each of them bursts into tears at least twice, and Octavia pretty much keeps up a running whimper throughout the morning. It turns out they really have become attached to me, and the idea of my returning to the arena has undone them. Combine that with the fact that by losing me, they'll be losing their ticket to all kinds of big social events, particularly my wedding, and the whole thing becomes unbearable. The idea of being strong for someone else having never entered their heads, I find myself in the position of having to console them. Since I'm the person going in to be slaughtered, this is somewhat annoying. It's interesting, though, when I think of what Peter said about the attendant on the train being unhappy about the victors having to fight again, about people in the capital not liking it. I still think all of that will be forgotten once the gong sounds, but it's something of a revelation that those in the capital feel anything at all about us. They certainly don't have a problem watching children murdered every year. But maybe they know too much about the victors, especially the ones who've been celebrities for ages, to forget we're human beings. It's more like watching your own friends die. More like the games are for those of us in the districts. By the time Cinna shows up, I am irritable and exhausted from comforting the prep team, especially because their constant tears are reminding me of the ones undoubtedly being shed at home. Standing there in my thin robe, with my stinging skin and heart, I know I can't bear even one more look of regret. So the moment he walks in the door, I snap, "I swear, if you cry, I'll kill you here and now." Cinna just smiles. "Had a damp morning?
You could ring me out, I reply. Cinna puts his arm around my shoulder and leads me into lunch. Don't worry. I always channel my emotions into my work. That way.